Hi, everyone. This is John Frank, Editorial Director of PL Buyer, welcoming you to this latest PL Buyer podcast. This podcast is the second in a series we're doing with Patrick Rodmel, President and CEO of Watt International, a Toronto-based integrated retail agency with more than 40 years of experience in more than 40 countries. Patrick also is a guest columnist with PL Buyer and will be co-chairing our new Best of Design Excellence Awards later this year, recognizing the best in private label package design. Today we'll be discussing Patrick's 10 Keys to Private Brand Success, the topic of his columns in PL Buyer this year. Hi, Patrick. Thanks for joining us today.
Nice to be talking with you, John.
Always good to have you. Let's begin by setting the scene for our discussion. Give us your thinking that led to the 10 Keys. Why did you put them together, and what can our readers and our listeners here gain from them?
Well, John, I guess I'll start with your second question there. What do I hope that people might be able to learn from this? The one thing I can promise is that I don't have the Holy Grail in my hands. This isn't so much about, delivering, the ultimate solution, the right solution. It's really a framework for effective decision making. You know, there's no one way to go about private label or private brands. We've kind of learned that through the 30 years of history with it here at Watt, and really the 10 keys are about identifying, specifically identifying the areas of private label development that we think are critical to success, and then hopefully setting a kind of a canvas for discovery, if you will, that's there for the retailer to kind of paint the picture that they think is the most appropriate. So this is more about a framework for discovery than it is the specific answers.
Okay. All right. Well, let's move into the framework. We're going to be focusing on key number two today, which is product quality management. This can be a very challenging assignment for a retailer. Where does a retailer begin tackling this issue of quality management?
Yeah, John, it's great. It goes, dovetailing on our discussion around the first key around branding and strategic brand positioning. You know, I always like to say that the package has to sell it once, but it's the product quality that makes it get bought a second time,
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't have this, that's why naturally it follows as a second key. First is the branding and packaging that helps to sell it the first time, and the second, of course, is that the quality expectations are delivered. Where do you start with understanding this? I think it starts with where you're at today and really understanding what are the consumer perceptions of your quality of your overall program. So let's not get into, dissecting the quality of your cereals or your specific SKUs. Let's go out and understand, what does a consumer think of the overall quality perception of the private label program? So it's sort of knowing where you want to go is key, right? Of course, that as we talked about earlier, but knowing where you're starting from is essential. And we always would say, let's get a really clear picture on where the consumer is perceiving the quality of your overall brand.
So start out with some consumer research to just find out where you stand.
Yeah, I think so, John. And it's, it's interesting. A lot of times our clients, come to us with some kind of research in that regard. But what they're missing is not just the quality perceptions of the people that currently shop their store, but those that don't. And the segmentation of the two, of course, can uncover some pretty enlightening insights. You know, the people that shop your store have a perception based on actually proof of concept, that is to say they're trying your products. But those on the outside who have a perception of the quality is not necessarily based on the actual quality, but on the perception of quality. And that's where it's good to find out, what do my existing or core customers think, and what do the people that don't shop my stores think? And that's where the research really comes in handy with understanding where the opportunities may be.
Oh, that's a great point. Look beyond your current customer base and see what
absolutely.
Because, of course, you always want to be expanding your customer base, right?
Yep, you can grow, you can grow with your existing, or you bring in new people, and they really are two different areas of opportunity to kind of capitalize on.
Take us through your thinking in your column a bit. You talk about three major sources of poor quality management. What are those, and how does a retailer prevent those from happening?
Well, the retailers and suppliers out there may think there's more than three or less than three, or these aren't the ones that percolate. But in our experience, these are the ones that kind of, if you will, rise to the top most often. And the first is really a lack of actionable quality management standards that are easy for people to follow and consistently enforced. And, you know, I look at the kind of the you know, the profiling that retailers put together at times for quality management, and they say things like must match the taste of the leading national brand. I don't even know how anybody could decide that was the case. You know, if I put two products in front of you and me, we might have different palates, and we may decide that it matches or it doesn't. And then the other question is, what is the leading national brand? Are we talking about the one that sells the most or is the highest in regards? So you really need to be much more granular in the ways that you want to define the quality standards. You know, and more importantly, identify the most relevant standards in each individual category for them. So that's kind of the lack of the actionable quality management standards is something that we see is kind of rising to the top. The second one is a lack of ongoing integration between marketers, the guys who often define the quality position for the brands, and the merchants and the buyers who actually go out and buy the stuff. And, you know, using words that are too vague and too and not specific enough, it's the moniker of marketers at times to give that kind of direction. That being said, what we need here are specifics. Quality management is not an event. It's a practice. It's a way of being. So really making sure there's a connection between the language of the marketers who define that quality position and the language of the people who actually have to act upon those is really critical to defining clear guardrails for quality management.
Would that necessitate bringing marketers into the process early in the product development process?
Honestly, John, it's actually the reverse. It's getting merchants more involved in the strategic development of positioning.
Okay.
You know, it's all about, you know, making sure that the people. I always find as a, you know, just a general way of operating, get the people who are, if you will, downstream in the process engaged as early on as possible, so that they understand and can contribute to strategic foundations and things of that nature. So I say, get the buyers and the merchants in on the discussion of brand positioning, strategy, quality definition, so that when they actually get assigned the task of executing against that, they've participated in putting it all together.
Okay, that's great.
The synergies work both ways, yeah.
And is there a third practice to avoid?
Yeah, sorry, sure. You know, and this is the one that every retailer kind of rolls their eyes at, but it has a lot to do with insufficient commitment of resources, that being money and people, required to manage the relationships and quality delivered through third-party suppliers. You know, I appreciate the you know, the broker community and being able to bridge between suppliers and retailers. But gosh, you know, if I'm going to put my name, if you're going to see Rodmel on any product quality, I'm going to make sure the one managing that quality is me or someone connected with me. You know, so it's always a tough pill to swallow, that kind of investment. Because it does add to the value equation. We understand that private label has that place as the, you know, a value provider in the consumer's basket. But I always say there's more room in the consumer's consideration set for a few extra pennies than there is for poor quality. That's really, at the end of the day, that's what needs to happen. So, you know, start it in the boardroom, but get it down to get it through the CFO's office and make sure the investment is there in terms of managing quality perceptions with the vendors.
Yeah. And that goes to the issue of trust with your vendors, doesn't it? And whether it be wholesalers or processors, if you're working directly with the contract manufacturer, how do you build that trust? Everyone talks about that. What does it mean, and how do you actually go about building that?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you bring that up. I think the trust is, I'm going to say, maybe a misnomer, or perhaps, you know, my the way I like to describe, I think, the best relationship, it's respectful collaboration. You know, the way you get trust, the way you earn trust, whether it's in the products you sell or the relationship you have, it comes from consistently delivering on expectations. That is to say, you know, in a relationship with a supplier, it's, do you always meet the standards that I'm expecting, you know, whether it's on time or a cost issue, but in the context of this conversation, it's about the trust that you deliver in the consistency of the product. And I think trust is what you earn through consistently delivering on expectations, but what we want is respectful collaboration between the two, understanding that it's not just selling the vendor's products. If it's got the retailer's name on it, they're the ones who live and die with the equity that's created from either meeting and succeeding expectations or not delivering against them.
Mm-hmm. Is there a lot of verification of quality involved here? I mean, should you be sending people out to plants or to wholesalers to try out their products?
Oh, you know, absolutely. That goes back full circle to that comment about investment. You know, I always think that verification is kind of like an insurance policy. Mm. It seems expensive when you don't need it, right? Like spending it, you say, why am I spending so much on this if you don't need it? But it's cheap when it pays off, you know? It's when the house burns down, insurance is awfully cheap, but it's that context of paying. So I find the challenge is that, you know, for when verification is successful, you almost never hear about it, right? And it's only the times, as I say, like uncovering a quality issue that before a product hits the shelf that you really say, hey, this thing pays off for me. So I love the comment about, you know, putting verification into trust. I think it's important. Mm-hmm. It's all a question of understanding that you don't always feel like you're getting the benefit, you know, for that. So
it's a little like the nuclear arms race, trust but verify here, to see what everyone's doing, right? Are retailers set up for that? Is that a difficult assignment for them to be maintaining sort of oversight on the quality of the products they're getting?
Well, I think that, you know, it goes back again to the comments about brokers. A lot of that is done by through third-party networks, mm-hmm. take on those kind of responsibilities and, mm-hmm. you know, who have those relationships. And that's where your comments about trust happen. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, I mean, I think it's there. It's where it's the relationship, really, frankly, between, you know, the broker when it gets to the retailer, that it really matters, that we have to make sure that that kind of verification on quality of products and really understanding what it is we're looking for and how do we all benefit from an investment in the insurance of verification for product quality, because it really can be something, as I say, that can get overlooked over time. It's sort of like taking advantage of the dog that's always at home when you get home, you know, you let that go too long and all of a sudden it doesn't wag its tail so hard when you walk in the door. So verification is, you know, it's a necessary investment in the future of quality management, John.
Okay, and summing up here, we're coming to the end of our podcast. The most important takeaway for our listeners about product quality management, what would you say that would be?
I would say, you know, it's commitment from the boardroom, not just in words, and that quality management isn't just an initiative, it's a way of operating. Mm-hmm. And I think really, you know, ensuring that there's that continuity and connectedness between the marketers who help to define the quality standards and the merchants who have to execute, that to me is the real key. It's if we can make sure that our guidance on quality management is very actionable and very specific and bought into by the organization, you find that, you know, the verification process will come up with fewer and fewer instances where quality is an issue.
Great. That's a great point to end on. Thank you very much, Patrick, for joining us today. Thanks for doing this series of podcasts with us. I invite our listeners to listen to all of our Appeal Buyer podcasts with Patrick and other industry leaders by visiting our website, privatelabelbuyer.com, where you can hear this and other podcasts. This is the second in a series of 10 we'll be doing with Patrick, so please come back to our website and watch for those as we load them on there. Thanks again, Patrick. Thanks to our listeners, and goodbye.
Always a pleasure, John.